Hello, welcome to the Guardian Book Club. This is John Mullen, and I'm talking to Hanif Qureshi about his novel, The Buddha of Suburbia. It's great that Hanif has come to talk about what, of course, was his first novel, but I think it's quite unusual as a first novel in that Hanif, I hardly need to tell you, I'm sure, but had already written successful plays and screenplays before he came to write a novel. I met a colleague of mine as I came out this evening who does one of the lectures on the suburbs, and I said what I was coming to do, and she said, rather sort of guileless reaction for an academic, she said, yes, fantastic, just gives you such an idea of what it must have been like in Bromley in the 1970s, which is that Bromley in the 1970s might have been a rather peculiarly weird and wonderful place. I mean, if you followed some of the anecdotes and instances from the novel. And I just wanted to ask if you were, well, I suppose if you were aware of that as you wrote, the sort of paradox that the narrator, of course, talks about the suburbs as a leaving place, somewhere he yearns to get away from. And yet it comes over in the novel as a sort of zone of eccentricity and licensed sportiveness, which kind of slightly belies this idea that it's a kind of proverbially tedious and conformist.
Well, it was rather tedious and conformist, I think, for the adults, but it was quite lively for the kids, and it's reasonably affluent. And you could afford like instruments and garages and stuff like that. But it was also the time, I'm talking really about the mid-60s, when people started to dress up as sort of skinheads, rockers, mods and so on. And Bowie had come from the suburbs. And so that sort of bisexuality, that kind of theatrical display that was around. And the other thing was that we were near London. So we could spend a lot of time on the train, you know, going from Bromley South up to Victoria, and then you were near the King's Road, so you had access to all the good stuff in Chelsea. And on Saturdays, we just walk up and down the King's Road looking around and see what was going on. So though it was really dull, I mean, you had access to drugs. There was a lot of LSD. My friend Rob was reminding me of Mandy's and stuff like that. And you could buy records and obviously listen to the radio and so on. So although it was a nowhere place, there was an exit, which was London. And I remember, you know, crossing the bridge, this Battersea Bridge into Victoria, you know, you'd cheer and go to the other side. You know, that was the moment of liberation.
But in the novel itself, the first two kind of incredibly memorable suburban scenes are, first of all, I guess the narrator's dad coming home, stripping off his clothes, standing on his head and being asking his son to read Yoga for Women, or is that the right title? Yeah. And then they go out on a bus journey, drop in on a pub where sort of Kevin Ayers is a reference, which my students don't understand that at all, but which sort of I plugged immediately into. And then they go somewhere where all these people are sitting around in a front room with chanting, playing. I mean, as a kind of picture of South London suburbia, it's quite a kind of wondrous, quite a beguiling one in a way.
Well, that's one night, do you know what I mean? People used to say to me, oh, you guys had a really good time in Bromley. And you thought, well, most of the time we were sitting at home like everybody else watching Steptoe and stuff. But, you know, there was fantastic parties and really good pubs and all that stuff down there. So, it was a good place to be a teenager because you had access to lots of things. And there were lots of parties and stuff like that.
And even the sort of, more conservative candidates, characters, have turn out quite often to have some aspect of kind of behaviour which is utterly unpredictable. Like, I remember Uncle Ted, who turns out to this terribly sort of straightforward DIY help you around the house man. But he has this alternative self as a football hooligan or a train vandal.
No, that was true. That did happen to me. I used to go and see Spurs which was quite far for us, and I remember being taken by the father of a friend of mine that I was at school with, and me and the boy were in the train on the way back, and the dad went mad in the carriage and started smashing up. He smashed up all the mirrors, he took all the lights out and threw them out the window, wrecked the whole carriage, he just went mad. And then, you know, those single carriages they had in the train. I remember going home and my mum saying to the boy's dad, you know, it was Hanif, well behaved. I hope, I hope he was a good boy. You know. And this guy just gone nuts in the train. It's absolutely true. Yeah.
So there are quite a bit. Are we allowed to? You don't mind people, when they read it, speculating about which bits of it are autobiographical? Because when I reread it, perhaps not the first time I read it, which was years ago, but certainly when I reread it, I kind of found myself inescapably doing that and sort of guessing.
I think you should take it as a rule that the most extreme bits are the most autobiographical. And because you wouldn't... Because you wouldn't make those bits up because you think nobody would believe it.
So Eva K comes somewhere from life, does she?
Oh, that's... Yeah, she was somebody's mum. She's always somebody's mum, somebody like that. Yes, it's very extra... I remember going around this boy's house, this incredible woman, very extravagant, sexual woman, playing this groovy music, you know, and thinking, this is just fantastic. I didn't realise there were people like this. Yeah, yeah.
And the father, Kareem's father, because I've been reading the book about discovering your father's novel... And a book, and which is a book partly about him, I suppose. And there's quite a, you know, I mean, now that's sort of, there are quite a lot of details which at the time perhaps I didn't assume were autobiographical, including even, I mean, the enthusiasm, he's an enthusiast for Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. Have I pronounced that right?
Yeah. And well, the orange guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, my dad loved all that, yeah. Because they were from Pune, where my father had lived. But I think my father was rather shocked when he read the book, in case he thought that people thought he had been doing this stuff. My dad was a rather respectable man.
And the narrator himself, Kareem, whom I suppose I don't at all identify with you. I mean, when you... but perhaps I'm wrong, perhaps I should more. When you wrote that... Was the business of getting this character's voice a very kind of, did it come naturally, or did you sort of brew the ingredients quite? Because as you know, I mean, I read the first column I wrote about your novel for the newspaper. I sort of tried to sort of, you know, in the way that I'm afraid sort of academics do, almost sort of list the things. Like, what does he do? What are the features of this voice that make it very memorable and distinctive?
Voice.
Yeah, the narrator's voice. But did you just write it, or did you fabricate it with, did you think, well, he's got a, you know, did you make it that peculiar mixture of, he sort of uses cliches and then really unexpected sort of sallies of simile, and he says kind of quite banal things. I mean, he's quoting F. Scott Fitzgerald the next minute. And I mean, it's an extraordinary kind of brew of stuff which seems to fit where he comes from.
That's how I talk. That's me. Sorry about that. Yeah. But also, I've been very influenced by those American sort of confessional books, things like Portnoy's Complaint, but particularly things like Catcher in the Rye, for instance. So the idea of directly, in this rather intimate way, addressing the reader had come from reading, I guess, American books. You know, let me tell you a story. This happened to me the other day, and writing it colloquial, you know, with lots of you knows, and that's how it was and all that.
Yes, yeah.
But it takes ages to find a voice, to find a style. I mean, I've been writing novels since I was 14. I wrote novels from the age of 14 until about the age of 18 or 19 when I went to work at the Royal Court for the first time. And after that, I started to write plays. But I've written loads of novels. I've written about 5 novels, which were all really The Buddha of Suburbia, which was really an attempt to try and come to terms with growing up in the suburbs at that time. And being, I was going to say, the only packy at my school, but there was another kid, Rob Roy, sitting over there who was at school with me. But it was quite hard to be an Indian in those days. And I was very interested in the way that, for instance, you were a packy on the street, or my father was a packy on the street. But at the same time, Indians were revered by George Harrison. by the Beatles, and Indians were seen as a recipient of this deep Eastern wisdom. At the same time, you were chased down the street by people who were gobbing at you. And so the book tries to capture the place of what it, you know, the meaning of what it was to be an Indian at that time and how odd it was and the different meanings it had for different people.
Yeah, it's a bit, isn't it? Karen says, there's no one, there can't have been anybody in Britain dressed as brilliantly as my dad, apart from George Harrison, maybe. Right. When And the clothes, did you get the, did you kind of, did you do all that from recollection, or did you... Because there's some brilliant stuff, not just about what Karim wears, but just about what the kind of John Collier brand of sort of...
It was quite hard.
Naff casual.
It was hard to write because it was quite hard to put all that stuff in a book because I'd never seen all that stuff in a book before. You know, writing about John Collier's and the trousers and the music and the everyday stuff that is now all the time in books. Mm. But actually, I remember thinking, when I wrote this at the end of the 80s, I remember thinking, can you put all this stuff in a book? Should it be in a book? Is it literary? I wanted to write a literary book, you know. I wanted to be a proper writer, and I thought, can you put all this crap in a book? Would it, you know, would it lower the tone of the book? Although it might seem perfectly natural then, you have to sort of invent a style for each book, and you wonder whether, you know, this is too much, this is, you know, is that the right amount, and whatever, should it go into a book? I mean, before... I mean, there weren't any Indians, really, writers. There were a few Indians. But the Indians were always published by a special publisher like Hutchinson or somewhere. And they're always in a special section in the bookshop. So there weren't any mainstream Indian writers, really, when I was a kid growing up. The American writers that I admired were people like Richard Bright and James Baldwin and so on. But to be an Indian writer in England was to be quite... It was quite a difficult thing, and you were quite a humble... You know, down the writing chain, there were a few Indians, but you sort of had to invent it. It was really with Midnight's Children that the idea of the Indian writer as an international, you know, full-on mainstream writer, that really changed the whole thing. That introduced, as it were, world writing, following Marquez with 100 Years of Solitude. But before that, to be an Indian writer in England wasn't to be part of the centre at all. All the writers in those days had English names like War and Forster and Amis. Now all the writers are Indian.
There's one actually.
All the writers are the newsreaders.
There's one character you bring into the novel, who comes in from India, doesn't he? Come from Bombay, Changez.
Oh yeah,
who's brought in?
He's fresh off the boat.
Yeah, yeah, and. And we kind of—it's really characteristic of Karim when he describes seeing him. His kind of nonchalant mixture of sort of South London teen demotic and sort of literary illusions, and he says he didn't look particularly like Flaubert, except for his moustache, you know. And he refers to him for a page or two as not Flaubert. I mean, the thing I always like about him as a narrator is that he doesn't, like all teenagers or like young people, he doesn't explain things. He just expects you to get his illusion. If you don't get it, well, you know. But Changez, I sort of think, metamorphoses. Or not metamorphoses, he changes a bit in the course of the novel.
Well, he goes to live in a lesbian convent.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah. I mean, he was a wonderful character to write.
Yeah, well, he feels like a wonderful...
Writing the really mad, the really eccentric characters are the most fun to write, because you start off with this bloke, he comes from India, he's going to have an arranged marriage with this girl, and then he marries the girl, and then she refuses to sleep with him. Then she has a baby with somebody else, then she goes to live in a lesbian commune, and I just have more and more fun sort of pushing it and having madder things happen.
But he sort of becomes, I think the other characters are, you know, there's lots of great characters in it, but I think he's the only one who actually, I think, rather changes in terms of the reader's sympathies, in that he is, partly he's a great comic character but at the beginning, but also perhaps partly because of the role he has in the plot, that he's being foisted on a character who you already quite enjoyed the company of. You perhaps as a reader slightly resent him, but kind of by the end he seems a hugely sympathetic person.
Yeah, he's great,
and he's you know, there's that bit right near the end about when he's talking about how, you know, being ugly because his wife doesn't want to sleep with him, all that. So inside I look like Shashi Kapoor. I know that for sure. Some people are really ugly pig faces and they have a terrible time and all. I'm beginning a national campaign to stop this prejudice. It should start stopping with you here in this damn house of the Holy Socialists. Fantastic sort of national campaign for ugly people. And I mean, is that because he's a character who sort of won over you as you went along? Because I think he wins over quite a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of those characters like the best ones that when you sort of start to write them and then you write more and you begin to really enjoy them and they get more and more mad and the whole thing gets more eccentric and you put them in weirder situations. I mean, one of the things I've noticed about other people is that the closer you get to them, it isn't that the more you understand them, it's the weirder they seem. People get, after a long time of knowing someone, you'd think you'd know them a bit better, wouldn't you? But actually, people get more and more psychotic the closer you get to them. And I feel that with my characters too, that they become more and more eccentric.
Yeah, that's something. I mean, that's something. It's a sort of something literary critics like to say when they sort of are putting their finger on why they like a particular novelist or why they think a particular novelist is better than others. And they will often say, it's because some of their characters will do something that surprises you.
Yeah.
You know. And academic literary critics, they always say, oh, it's because some of their characters surprise even their authors, you see. That's why George Eliot's good, she had this character, and the character turned around and did something different from what was expected.
Well, in the end, all writing, I realised, because I teach writing, in the end, all writing and the pleasure of reading and the pleasure of writing is really to do with the development and the making up of characters. Even the most basic writer, someone like Beckett, has got people sitting in sort of pots and holes in the ground and stuff. But they're fantastic characters. They're great characters. They're recognisable characters. And it's that, the ability to do that, that makes somebody into a writer, I think. To make a character that actually you believe, that seems alive, that seems independent of the author. And that's the trick. That's the hard thing to do. I don't know how you do it.
Well, one of the places, I mean, you talked about doing stuff for the theatre. And there seem to be two ways in which the Buddha of Suburbia owes quite a lot to your writing the theatre. I mean, and one is that it has fantastic sort of set pieces in a way of sort of dialogue and farcical events. But the other is there's lots about the theatre in it, isn't there? And there's lots of the characters. I mean, it has a very... it has a wonderfully satirical and extremely jaundiced sort of view of the theatre, does it not?
Well, yeah. I mean, I went to work in the theatre when I was 18, and I love the theatre, and I love directors, I love actors. I spent my life with performers of some sort, and they are the most strange and eccentric people, and particularly the theatre of the 70s, which was very right on, very radical, you know, and everyone was communist, and we sit around in groups doing Maoist self-examinations, you know, and everybody's father was a doctor. And they're all playing Chinese peasants, you know. And then they had to confess their class crimes and so on. It was really funny. How could you not put that in?
There's a great moment where, so Karim is kind of expressing, not critically, but sort of ecstatically, how thrilling it all is when he's doing the theatre for the sort of that ghastly man Pike, and he says how you know, what a distance he's travelled from suburbia, how none of the people in our street who are paying for it through their taxes, what would they have made of a gang of grown-ups being pop-up toasters, surfboards and typewriters in one of their one of their practice sessions. So there's a kind of, for him it's all sort of a thrill, isn't it? But I mean, it seems like a wonderful opportunity for the novelist, for you, to parade an extraordinary kind of gallery of vanities and the man who's running it all, the impresario, is unbelievably predatory. And is he taken from life, dare I ask? Is he?
Well, actually, that character is much more based on the character in The History Man. Do you remember that Malcolm Bradbury novel, a wonderful novel set in university? I haven't read the book, but I saw it on the telly. with Anthony Scher playing the character.
Howard Kirk.
And he fucks all the girls. He's very left-wing. And I kind of stole the character from there because it's such a, you know, an intriguing, such a characteristic figure from that time, I guess,
And do you think that kind of... Is that figure characteristic of the time, then? I mean...
Well, directors have a lot of power. At the same time, because we were also left-wing, the idea was that the power had to be shared around among all the actors. So we had these huge, long, endless discussions in these groups. But in the end, what the director wanted was always what you did. So it was, the whole thing was rather futile and stupid. But it was also, it was the first time, in a way, that in the theatre, that we began to talk about race and immigration, actually. That's what interested me. When I first went to work with Joint Stock and Max Arthur Clarke at the Royal Court, it was really to do with, we went down to Southall and began to talk about race, to talk about Islam, to talk about integration, all the stuff that we now think and talk about all the time. It was the first time I really became aware of that as a theatrical subject. I mean, we now think of this race and all of it as being a central subject, but it took ages for it to move into the centre of the discourse, for anybody to be interested in it. I mean, I used to write plays for television and send them to people, and they always used to say, why do you have to have all these Asian people in them all the time? You know, why can't you write about white people like everybody else? Because you can clearly write, but putting this Asian stuff in it is really putting people off. And it was really tricky to break through and to get your voice heard and for people to think that this was a subject that people would be interested in. It wasn't really until much later, My Beautiful Laundrette in 84, that people saw that you could do a film about this stuff and actually, you know, reach a mass audience. But it was a huge struggle. It took ages.
You make Karim quite sort of... You artfully make Karim himself quite sort of... Really quite so careless. I mean, is that right? I suppose I take him as a character to be quite careless of politics, really. Quite, as my sister would say, Bolivious a lot of the time. He's Bolivious. Although he has all these friends or associates who spout stuff at him, almost invariably his motives for sitting and listening to them have got nothing to do with what they're saying.
Right, yeah. I guess that was, I was like that. I'm still like that. I mean, you just go along things being because you're curious. And lots of my friends were in politics. A lot of the actors were in the SWP and the WRP and, and doing all that stuff.
But maybe to write, I don't know, maybe to have this kind of novel, which is, I don't know, people call it a picaresque novel or, a kind of coming-of-age novel or something. Maybe you need a sort of... I know he's not exactly innocent, that's the wrong word for him, but somebody who sort of... He sort of wanders through these...
Well, he is quite innocent at the beginning. I mean, he's never seen all this stuff before, so he is innocent. He's really wide-eyed and really impressed by it, really knocked out by the weirdness, the strangeness.
Yeah.
Also, it was a really big deal to get away from Bromley. You know, I mean, you could be started to still be there working in a shop. My kids have such a sense of privilege, such a sense of living in a safe world. But I thought, you know, if you don't get out of Bromley, if you don't make the break, if you don't go to London and work in the theatre, you'll never get out of there. You'll be stuck there. And that's, in a way, something that happened to my father. So getting away was a real big deal for us, and getting educated and getting out and leading a creative life. You know, you get about 2 years after you leave school when you can or not get away. And some of my mates are still there working in shops and stuff like that.
Well, Karim, actually, I know I said my theory at the beginning, but the more I think about it, the truer it is. It seems to me that he is quite like one of his characters from an 18th century novel by Fielding or something, in that he manages to sort of, he has sex with people and he's quite interested in that. But he is quite sort of wide-eyed, actually, isn't he? He is quite, in a way, he's quite sort of unworldly and quite, sort of uncorrupted by the world, actually.
Yeah, he's shocked by things. That's what you want. People who are shocked by things, who are impressed by things, that's the whole idea of it, yeah.
One thing he does, which is sort of... didn't used to be allowed in novels, and actually it didn't used to be allowed until quite recently, is he swears quite a lot. I wanted to ask you about... Is that okay? I'm fascinated by the subject. Sad, I know. Swearing in novels, you know. And he swears in... I mean, I don't mean just in the dialogue people swear, but he swears sometimes. And it's quite a sort of... You must be quite conscious of it, because people... his aunt says, oh, you mustn't swear. And he says about Eva, oh, she's so fantastic, and she uses the word fuck, and, you know, she's this kind of amazing presence in Chislehurst.
Not so far than that. Yeah.
Did you very carefully rack? I mean, did you in 1990s? Was it quite normal to have a kind of narrator of a novel swearing, or did you, because you ration it out quite carefully?
Well, with the telly, yeah, we had a lot of trouble with the telly when we did it on the telly. I've got a list actually from Alan Yentop, and he's written down all the words: Jesus fucking Christ, fuck, shit, bollocks, you know, and how many you're going to have in each episode. And it goes out the episodes. He says there are too many fucks in episode 3, but if you can move them more to episode 2, then we can even it out. But in episode 4, he says, Jesus fucking Christ, you can't say that anyway, anywhere. Well, I wanted it to be quite an aggressive book. I wanted it to be quite a punky book. I wanted it to be quite a sharp book. I wanted it to be a book that was the way I felt inside then, and a book that was like other English books, I guess. You call it picaresque, but also like a sitcom and with lots of farce in it, you know. All the stuff I liked in the same place, that's basically what you try and do as a writer. You try and find out what's inside you and mix it up and try and get that onto the page. It's a nightmare to do, really tricky to do.
But it's funny you say that, because it did sort of seem to, I don't know if you want to pass judgment on the TV version, but there were some things about the novel which I had associated with you being a dramatist and a screenplay writer rather than with you thinking of television at all, which did seem to make it, wonderfully visualisable, and also some of the dialogue you could, you know, adapt quite readily. Yeah. In a way that isn't true of all good contemporary fiction at all.
I was really pleased when it was done on the telly, and I think the telly version's fantastic, and the music was really good.
Yeah.
The actors are fantastic in it. But it wasn't written, I didn't have that in mind. I mean, I'd written for the theatre, and I'd written two movies, My Beautiful Laundrette and Sammy and Rosie. It was the first time in my life I'd had any money, so I had a bit of window when I could actually sit down and write this book. But it was all sort of waiting to go. I think I felt rather ashamed that I was only a screenwriter or a playwright. I thought being the real deal was to be a novelist, you know. And I remember someone saying this thing to me, you've got to write a novel, that's the thing. You can't only be a screenwriter. And I thought, well, that's right. Uh-huh. That's right, because you always think, is it me or is it Daniel Day-Lewis that makes this film? So, obviously it's Daniel Day-Lewis.
Well, it's funny, it didn't used to be like that in the sort of 70s. I think.
What?
It was plays. You plays were the kind of, weren't they, the serious thing to write if you're an ambitious writer?
Yeah. Yeah, the theatre was really lively in those days. There were lots of good writers around. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It didn't really suit me writing for the theatre, actually, because it was very hard to find Asian actors. There were only about 3 Asian actors in London. I remember when we were casting My Beautiful Laundrette, and being at Stephen Frears' house, and one of the girls came to see Stephen. Stephen said to her, do you know any other actors? Do you know any other Asian people who'd like to be in this film? Because we couldn't find anybody to be in it, because there wasn't any work for Asian actors, and most of them were either working in India or they were, you know, did little bits of sitcoms in Britain, but mostly they didn't work at all. So working for the theatre was really tricky for an Asian or a black writer, because you couldn't get anybody to be in the plays, and they would only be done once. You couldn't get them done all over in the way that everybody else had their plays done all over, as it were.
I just wanted to ask one, before I throw it open, I wanted to ask one final question, which is reference to something you've just mentioned about the music, because I agree, it was the TV version, one of the great things about it was the music was suddenly there in it. I suppose when I first read it, I took that, and not just because of the fact that the protagonist, like you, went to the same school as David Bowie, and it seems like that's, you know, Bromley's most famous resident, even beating H.G. Wells. But it's felt at the time like that was the most... That must be autobiographical, you know. Yeah. Well, the kind of references to King Crimson, only somebody who'd been benighted enough to be sort of sucked into the vortex of King Crimson could...
I'm King Crimson, I'm not having it.
was that all kind of... I mean, that didn't feel like research, that felt like sort of...
Well, music was our culture, it was our language, it was the thing that we all had in common. We didn't sit around talking about books, we didn't have any other culture. But there was all this new music, and it was coming out all the time, and our friends were in bands, and Bowie had been in Bromley, he was 10 years older than me, he was gone by then. And there was all this music coming from America, you know, and you'll find lots of people of that time, that generation, talking about the impact that music had on them. And it was, you know, it was multiracial.
But there's a funny thing about it, which is dramatised in the plot, which is one day, Karim goes to along to this sort of hellish pub in West Kensington, and suddenly there's
the
something
Nashville,
else.
Nashville. That's the Nashville.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And there's something else. Suddenly there's all this kind of there's a new thing, and all this kind of purple flares and umma gumma, which to me was incredibly vivid. God, I remember first listening to Umma Gumma. But then I also remember a few years later the moment which is dramatised in the novel where you suddenly think, well, no, Umma Gumma, that's got to go.
Mm. Yeah, there was a moment when it all changed and everybody had to get their hair cut and had to get black clothes on and all that. And that was around 1976, I guess, after Vivian Westwood and McLaren and the Sex Pistols, around that time and then the Clash. Yeah, and you had to be sharp if you were going to be into the new thing.
And you've got this character, Charlie, who's sort of
changes his clothes. Yeah. Comes out as a punk. And I remember people literally, sort of doing that.
Yeah, yeah. He's a sort of... He's a sexier Widmerpool, isn't he? Whatever
it's very
happens.
It's shameful to be a hippie, suddenly. So, yeah, that's right.
It's more past the time when I should give you all a chance. I'm afraid, as has been said... You'll have to have the microphone, not because we can't hear you otherwise, but for the podcast. So if you'd like to put your hands out, anybody who'd like to ask, say, refute anything?
Right now I'm thinking about some of the essays that you wrote in London Kills Me, and I really enjoyed reading them, and you had such foresight at looking at the ones you wrote in the 80s. But what I would really like to see and wonder if you're doing is working on a book of essays or a memoir.
The lady there was referring to some essays I wrote in the 80s and asks me what I'm doing now. Well, I've written a novel called Something to Tell You, which is really probably the other end of the Buddha of Suburbia, i.e. it starts in the 70s but goes up to 2005 and ends with the bombings in London in 2005. And it's a bit like the Buddha of Suburbia, except the people are much older and much more sadder, and indeed many of them are dying. But otherwise, it's the same. Except that, 55-year-old at an orgy isn't quite the same spectacle as a 25-year-old. So it's a bit more wretched. But it's the same kind of thing. It's like a sort of big pot, which I've thrown in lots of characters and scenes and bad stuff and drugs and even stuff about psychoanalysis and anything that what you want to do as a writer is find a shape, find a plot, find a kind of way of organising this material that enables you to think about all the stuff you're thinking about at once. That's what you try and do. And so I've written this big book. I realised the other day when I was 50 that I'd been alive, seemed a miracle to me, 50 years. It was a long time that I'd lived through something which used to be described as the sexual revolution too, as well as the Iraq war. So I've written a book containing lots of stuff that I've been thinking about over the last 5 or 6 years. It took me ages to do, and it begins in Bromley. Can't say fairer than that. It begins in Bromley in the 70s, and it's about a boy and a girl, and it ends up with these two people at the end of the book in 2005. So that's been keeping me a bit busy.
In the middle, and then at the back.
There was one moment towards the end of the book when you come back from America and you have to go to the dentist, and the South African dentist says, "Does he speak much English? A few words." And I was just kind of interested in kind of the racism that you might have experienced living in Bromley in South London, and kind of through your life, and how that might have changed over the years, or kind of attitudes changing from all areas.
Well, I hadn't thought about it for ages, about race and racism, and I thought they didn't apply to me anymore. And I seem to have got paler over the years as well. So I stand out less. But I was in Germany last week doing publicity for my new book, and almost all the journalists that I met referred to me as an immigrant. And I thought, no one's called me an immigrant for years, And anyway, my mother would be horrified, And they talked about you, and they kept saying, as an immigrant, you feel more at home now in England, they kept saying. And they said, and then someone said to me, did you accept your CBE from the other day? In order that you might feel more English. And I thought, fucking hell, I haven't heard any of this for ages. This isn't, direct racism, but it's the assumptions that people have about you. And I guess it was that I wanted to write about in The Buddha of Suburbia, that you go to someone's house and they go, oh, he's a packy, Or as they said about me in Germany, he's an immigrant, you know, are you feeling better about England now? Do you fit in a bit better? Stuff like that. And it's sort of horrifying. You suddenly think, oh, they just think about you as a group, you know. And I think I started to write at all in the first place because I felt swamped and terrified by all that stuff. That in a way, it's as though you're having your sort of identity rubbed out. You're in the same group as other people and you're a load of packers and you've come to their country and you're taking their jobs and they hate you. And you think, well, how can I get out from under all this? Well, one way in which you get out from under all this is to sort of write books and to assert yourself and to find an identity and to make an identity through writing books, I guess. And I think that's how I found myself, and that writing was the way in which I stopped myself from going mad. And Britain was certainly much more overtly racist in those days than it probably is now. But there is a new sort of racism which is growing in Europe, which I was aware of in Germany and I think I'm aware of in England, which is to do with racism against Muslims and so on. It's not as though the Muslims have helped themselves. They've had, as it were, some bad PR. But I think the temptations of racism are always there, particularly in other countries in Europe, in Italy and Germany, as I say, and also in France, where they still think of Asians or black people or Muslim people as sort of other, the strangers who are outside, who don't really belong to you. And I think, and when I get that, when someone says to me, as an immigrant, are you beginning to feel more settled in England? I'm really shocked by that, because I'd like to think that Britain has changed, that I'm English, that I'm British, and so on. So you suddenly see what racism does, how it sort of smashes your identity and places you outside, and how shocking that is, and the ideas that people have about you really affect your identity and the way in which you see yourself, i.e. you begin to hate yourself, you begin to identify with them, you begin to see yourself as a strange alien person. And I think The Brutal Suburbia was an attempt, as it were, to save my own life in terms of the way other people saw me.
It's a very sort of... I don't know who the German questioners were, but I remember when I used to teach, I taught English in Germany, English literature in Germany for a while, and it's a very characteristic sort of German thing amongst... They had a category, they take the English novel very, very seriously, you know, and really, really... But then they have a category called, you know, the British immigrant novel, and they... think, you know, Kazuo Ishiguro is a Japanese novelist.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, really?
He's a Japanese novelist.
Yeah.
And you say, well, you know, I'm not sure how Japanese he is as a novelist. But, I mean, that's a kind of... So maybe it was kind of part of that as well, that they have these sort of, you know, kind of literary categories that they sort of use in order to teach and write about British fiction.
I have to say I was really shocked by it. I hadn't thought about myself as an immigrant in that way before for ages, actually.
I think William Golding once talked about good writing as coming off the page at you like a fist. And I wondered if you ever wanted to hit anybody with your writing and who that might be.
William Golding, you mentioned. He wrote a fantastic book with a great title that everybody at Faber really enjoys, called Fire Down Below. It's one of our favourite books. Well, what you do when you write a book is try and make it interesting for other people. And you have to bear that in mind. You think, you know... When you're teaching writing, you think, should this be on the first page? Should this be on the second page? You know, how do you draw people in? You shock people, you interest them, you turn them on, you try all kinds of stuff. You know, you do whatever you can to keep people interested in what you're doing. But what you are really as a writer is you're the first reader, right? So I read a book. I mean, I write a character, say, like in My Beautiful Laundrette, I was thinking, it's a good illustration, there's these two blokes, they're running a laundrette together, and you think, fuck, maybe they should kiss, what a great idea. They kiss, that'd be really shocking, be fantastic. So, all right, then they kiss. And then when you see the film and they kiss, it's shocking too. It's unexpected. So what you try and do is keep in what's unexpected for you and shocking for you as it occurs to you. Right, and so, you know, you're in the position of the writer and the reader at the same time. So, you know, a book is a series of tricks in the hopeless and hopeful attempt of trying to interest other people. And you do whatever you can. You know, sometimes it's like a fist, sometimes like it's a caress, sometimes it's a joke, sometimes it's whatever you need to keep the plot and the reader interested. But basically, that's all you're trying to do. It's a strip show. You know, and in the end, you're not trying to get too naked too soon. You've got to keep it going so that people keep watching.
I was lucky enough to be part of the Buddha Suburbia when it was filmed. But I remember at that time thinking, wow, I want to be a Karim, and I thought, you know, absolutely amazing. But do you find in today's world that there is less of a Karim because these experiences that he's had has become everyday experiences for everyone, and it's less shockable for the people reading or watching movies such as The Buddha of Suburbia?
This gentleman who's asked the question actually is in The Buddha of Suburbia and plays the little brother.
Oh, really? You're the little brother who wears a hairnet? Yes. And red silk pajamas. Yeah. He's fantastically cool. He is. He's the.
Well, it seems to be wonderful that we've advanced to a stage where Muslim writing, where Asian writing, where black writing is far the mainstream in Britain, you know, and that all the names have changed from being, you know, English names into being Asian, black, and so on names, that we are making some sort of multiracial, some sort of multicultural society. That seems to me to be a huge advance, you know, and it seemed to me that it changed around in the 80s, as I say, particularly with the publication of Midnight's Children and then with films like My Beautiful Laundrette and so on. But it was a big effort, and it was a long time, and everybody struggled really hard to get to this space, you know. And when you go to somewhere like Germany, and you see it's not like that at all, and they can, you know, consider immigrant writing to be far out there and very marginalised and so on, you can see that what a struggle it's been. And I think that absolutely, when the fact that these kinds of experiences seem more common, you know, and loads of people come up to you and say, oh, that's my experience in so-and-so, and there is a book that you can turn to where it's all in, seems to me to be a huge advance, that we've come very far and worked really hard to make some sort of multiracial society, and it's very valuable, and it's been a very important thing. We have to hang on to it.
Well, it's fantastic to have Hanif coming to talk to us this evening. He'll sign books, I'm sure, and just for me to say thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Now we've got a little table.